So a few weeks ago, when I was preaching another section of Genesis, Larry Bergstresser said, "So, what are you going to do with Genesis 34? And I said, "Well, I'm not sure, Larry." So now you're about to find out. Genesis 34 is the story of, it's often labeled, the rape of Dinah. And so let us see what we find there. Beginning at the first verse. "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the region. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the region, saw her, he seized her and lay with her by force. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, 'Get me this girl to be my wife.' Now Jacob heard that Shechem had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his cattle in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him, just as the sons of Jacob came in from the field. When they heard of it, the men were indignant and very angry, because he had committed an outrage in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with him, saying, 'The heart of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall live with us and the land shall be open to you. Live and trade in it and get property in it.' Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, 'Let me find favor with you, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Put the marriage present and the gift as high as you like, and I will give you whatever you ask me. Only give me the girl to be my wife.' The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully, because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, 'We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, that you will become as we are, and every male among you be circumcised. Then we will give you our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live among you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take advantage of our daughter, we will take our daughter and be gone.' Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his family, so Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, 'These people are friendly with us. Let them live in the land and trade in it, for the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will they agree to live among us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and all their animals be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will live among us.' And all who went out of the city gate heeded Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. On the third day, when they were still in pain, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city unawares and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. And the other sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city, because their sister had been defiled. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field, and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses they captured and made their prey. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have brought trouble on me by making me odious to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, And if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household. But they said, should our sister be treated like a whore? Here ends our reading from Genesis. Let us pray. Gracious God, fill our hearts with your Spirit and our minds with your thoughts, that we might know your will this day, that we might hear in your word a word for us. Amen. The account of Dinah's rape and of the terrible revenge extracted by her brothers is one of the most hotly debated stories in all biblical interpretation. Where one reader sees a hero, another sees a scoundrel, nearly every episode in this exquisitely told story is ambiguous enough to give the reader many options. Its message is anything but clear-cut. We are still in the town of Shechem, that city in Canaan, where Jacob came peacefully and settled. And he must by now have been there for some years, for his younger children are now young adults. Jacob and his clan have been living for several years among the Canaanites. And one day, Dinah goes out to visit the women of the region, and she is raped by Hamor's son, Shechem. But even that is murky. Some readers suggest that Dinah had no business going out to visit the Canaanite women. Moral young women in that time would not go out to neighboring neighborhoods without an escort, they say. Some even add that visiting the Canaanite women at all would have been inappropriate. But other readers note that Jacob's family and the Canaanites are living side by side in peace, and that Jacob seems even to have incorporated the name of the Canaanite god El into the name of the God of Israel, so the people may be more intermingled than the story suggests. And these readers also point out that it's wrong to blame Dinah for bringing the rape on herself by visiting neighboring women. It sounds like the people in our day who say that women who wear alluring clothing are asking to be raped. Then there's the rapist Shechem. For some readers, Shechem is simply a despicable person, a man who tries to buy his way out of trouble claiming love for Dinah. But others are more generous and say he was trying to do the right thing. And still others will tell you that the whole story is a much earlier version of Romeo and Juliet. Dinah and Shechem are of differing clans, and when Dinah visits the Canaanite women, she and Shechem fall in love and want to marry. But the two clans cannot get together, and tragedy follows. So one side says that Shechem raped and kidnapped Dinah, the other that Dinah elected to be with Shechem because she loved him. Either way, Dinah's brothers are having none of it. In their minds, their sister has been raped and intermarriage with the Canaanites is out of the question. And they pretend to agree to the marriage, but require the Canaanites to be circumcised. Now, while the Canaanite men are incapacitated by the agony of the surgery, Dinah's brothers slaughter all of them and take their women and their belongings for themselves. Some readers see the brothers' actions as justified. They took revenge for their sister's defilement. Others, a little more restrained, are uncomfortable with the scale of the revenge. Hammurabi famously tried to temper the settling of scores in the ancient world, an eye for an eye. That was what revenge could not exceed. It could not exceed the original crime. And Dinah's brothers visited far more than their share of vengeance on the Canaanites. And these readers still say that. And still others, like Jacob, see the brothers' impetuousness in political terms. You have brought trouble on me by making me odious to the inhabitants of the land. My numbers are few, and I shall be destroyed, says Jacob. But readers have also been ambivalent about Jacob too. Some have read him as a wise peacemaker whose project of living peaceably in the land is now obliterated by his hot-headed sons. And others have said that in this story we find Jacob now in ineffectual old age. He's a shell of himself, shows no moral courage, and leaves his sons to exclaim, "Should our sister be treated like a whore?" So, is Dinah an innocent victim, a temptress, a star-crossed lover? Is Shechem a brutal rapist who may or may not have repented of his crime, or is he too a man in love, caught between the cultural and religious currents of his time? Are Dinah's brothers shining knights who rescue their sister and punish her rapist appropriately, or are they overzealous hotheads who mete out punishment far in excess of the crime, or worse, do they slaughter a whole town for the honor of their sister who has simply fallen in love with someone from the other side of the tracks? And is Jacob still the wise and in his wisdom now the distressed leader of the chosen people? Or is his star, not to mention his courage, fading out of sight? Well, the simple answer is yes. Yes, any of these interpretations is possible. If nothing else, the inconclusiveness of the narrative testifies to the genius of the storyteller. In these short verses, we find a complex tale with possibilities that lead in a plethora of contradictory directions. That is, these short verses brilliantly capture life. There is hardly a story told today on the world stage that doesn't leave and have such incongruity. Listen to the narratives, ranging from the Middle East to the halls of Congress, describing the very same events and situations. Different storytellers are in profound disagreement, not only over the interpretation of the events, but also sometimes over the very facts. Watching the news, in my experience, is enough to boggle the mind. But no matter how one tells stories, no matter how one interprets the motivations of the players, things happen here in this story and in life. Big things. The story of recent wars is told in 100 conflicting versions. But what is sure is that in the conflicts of recent years, more than 100,000 Syrian citizens lay dead, and more than that number Afghanis and Iraqis. So too it is with our ancient story. If the exact plot of this ancient story is confusing in many of its aspects, certain outcomes are clear and enormous. We don't hear the impact that the whole thing had on Dinah. But no matter how one tells the story, it had to be significant. We do know that a whole city full of people was wiped out. And we know that the city of Shechem was but the center of a loosely confederated city-state. And so while Jacob's sons wiped out Shechem, they stirred a hornet's nest among the rest of the Canaanites. And Jacob was right. He and his clan became odious to the inhabitants of the land, and they had to move out of the land, not to really return and prosper there for centuries. The outcomes of the story were gigantic, and in many ways very sad. And few of the players, I would say, saw all of it coming. Indeed, no one saw the full implications of their actions coming. No matter Dinah's intention in visiting the girls in the Canaanite section of town, she surely never foresaw the coming slaughter of Shechem and the forced flight of her people. And neither did Shechem himself, whether he was a lover or a rapist, nor did Dinah's brothers when they perpetuated the slaughter. Jacob foresees the outcome, but by then, it's all but plainly written on the wall. Hitler gathered crowds of cheering enthusiasts as the decade of the 1930s began. But even those who worried did not foresee the full extent of the extermination that would unfold in such a short while. The industrial age promised prosperity, but who foresaw that its chimneys would threaten to choke the life out of the planet? Our Puritan forebears came to these very shores to build a city on a hill, a new promised land, but none of them, I would venture, foresaw the full and brutal displacement of native populations that would follow. Great consequences often seem to be upon us before we know it, and almost too often too late to change them. It's a story as old as the hills and as modern as today's news cycle. Now, why do momentous consequences catch us so unawares? And maybe more important, is there a way out? Can we do a better job in seeing what is coming? And today's story gives us a little help, I think. It's genuinely hard to see how smaller events will unfold. It's what Edward Lorenz calls the butterfly effect. A butterfly flapping its wings on the other side of the globe makes a small disturbance in the air currents, but this disturbance affects something else, it hits something else, and on, until a few days later, a hurricane arises on the other side of the globe. But a lot of steps have happened in between, and many other things besides the butterfly have contributed to the hurricane. So here's the deal. Dinah goes out to visit the Canaanite women. But there's no way that she could have thought, oh dear, I'm going to be raped, my brothers are going to be mad, they're going to trick the whole city into being circumcised and then murder them, and then we'll all have to flee for our lives. Whatever trouble she thought or didn't think she was inviting, she never could have seen or said beforehand all of what visiting the Canaanite women would lead to. And of course, it's not just Dinah. Shechem, whatever the trouble he thought or didn't think he was courting, didn't see the full extent of his actions. And the same could be said of Dinah's brothers, although one could argue that they were close enough to the end of the story to see where it was all headed. So here's the problem. Since we cannot know the impact of flapping our wings, it's awfully easy for us to excuse ourselves from thinking much about it. But the God of ancient Israel does not accept such excuses. In a later text, he will tell the people, I lay before you blessing and curse, life and death. Choose life. The God of Israel didn't mean that all of a sudden the people would have a crystal ball. But the God of Israel did mean that certain behaviors tended to lead to bad results. Miss Whitlock was my first grade teacher. It was just a couple of years after the great Brinks robbery of Boston. Miss Whitlock was a formidable woman in her 50s with a stern look and a high degree of moral certainty. Miss Whitlock told us cowering students, those men who robbed the Brinks truck, you know how they got their start? Stealing pencils in school. That's right, stealing pencils in school. Let that be a lesson to you before you take any more pencils from my desk. My parochial school friends told me that their teacher promised even more dire ends if they stole pencils from her, so we were lucky. But either way, we learned early on that crime started small, and one crime inevitably led to another, and before long you'd be in the clink or worse, and then who would care about you? Well, of course, Miss Whitlock wasn't entirely wrong, was she? One thing does lead to another. It did in ancient Shechem, to be sure. It wasn't necessarily crime leading to crime, but one thing, one judgment, one decision, one move inexorably led to the next. And it would be difficult to draw hard and fast morals from our story. Life. It eludes easy answers. But the story does beg for careful consideration of one's actions. Dinah might have acted differently, though I will not be the first to cast a stone in her direction. And at every step of the way, after that, the players in the stories made decisions. But one led to another. Things could have ended differently. Shechem could have curtailed his passion. Jacob could have intervened to prevent his sons from slaughtering the Canaanites. Dinah's brothers could have acted with more self-control. At any number of points, a different fluttering of the butterfly wings could have changed the course of the story for the better. So at the end, we don't learn much, but we learn that one thing led to another, but it didn't have to lead where it did.